Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars, artists, and librarians about the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very delighted to have as a returning guest on the program today the cultural critic and art historian Dora Appel. Dora is the W. Hawkins Ferry Professor Emerita in Modern and Contemporary Art History at Wayne State University in Detroit. Among her books are The Imagery of Lynching, Black Men, White Women, and the Mob, Memory Effects, The Holocaust, and The Art of Secondary Witnessing. And Dora visited us this past year to talk about her latest book, Calling Memory into Place, published in 2020 by Rutgers University Press. She's also published numerous articles in journals, including Jacobin, Brooklyn Rail, Art Bulletin, Art Journal, Oxford Art Journal, New German Critique, American Quarterly, Dissent, and the Journal of Visual Culture. She is the editor or co-editor of 10 exhibition catalogs for the Cranbrook Art Museum. She's a lifetime member of the WSU Academy of Scholars. And she's with us today to talk about her book, Beautiful Terrible Ruins, Detroit and the Anxiety of Decline, published in 2015 by Rutgers. Welcome back, Dora.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on the show again. So just to start, you know, in the spirit of full disclosure, this is a book about my hometown, Detroit, Michigan. So it was of keen interest to me. Detroit is a place I left a little over 50 years ago, and I haven't been back much, so that much of the decline that you write about happened after I left. And so your account was more than a little painful, I have to say, to me, since I don't get back there very often. And I've often wondered why, for instance, it was that so many of the schools and public libraries that I used to attend when I was a child there are either gone or boarded up now when I return virtually now, which I can do, you know, using Google Street Maps. But I expect the fate of the city has been a lot more painful to people that have been living in the city all this time, which includes yourself. I was just reading an essay by an educational icon here at Vassar, the historian Lucy Maynard Salmon, who pioneered a research curriculum here at the turn of the 20th century, first research curriculum in an undergraduate institution, actually, as a way of empowering women. She felt it was important to introduce the seminar model to education here. And the essay is entitled History in a Backyard, which was about finding historical evidence in things that are close at hand, which Lucy was also known for. And this is precisely what you seem to have done in this book about your own backyard and front yard as well in Detroit there. So I wonder if you can tell us, to begin with, what inspired you to write the book?
Well, since I live in Detroit, I would often drive by the ruins of businesses, homes, and civic structures, which I found horrifying, but also fascinating. So it didn't surprise me that so many people wanted to photograph the ruins, both local citizens and photographers from out of town. What did surprise me was the contempt and criticism a lot of locals started voicing against those photographers who came from out of town. So I wanted to understand that better. I also wanted to understand the fascination of the ruins themselves. And I wanted to understand the implied critique of the phrase ruin porn, which seemed weak and problematic to me, since it seemed apparent that pretty much everyone was drawn to imagery of ruins, as well as to the ruins themselves. So I wondered if ruins were becoming fetishized, but also wondered what the growing fascination with ruins said about our historical moment, about capitalist culture, and about the widespread fear of continuing social decline.
So this book also has to do with another sort of backyard of yours, the discipline of art history. And you mentioned photography and our fascination with ruins, which is a big part of art historical iconography. The question, I suppose, is part of your book about the representation of urban decline in the art world, which then includes photographers, but it also includes other kinds of representation?
Yeah, all kinds of visual artists have engaged in substantial ways with urban ruins for some time, especially in Detroit. mean, these include films and documentaries about Detroit by filmmakers that attempt to narrate the processes of ruination. And this includes films like Detropia, Detroit, Requiem for a City, and DeForce, A History of Tyranny in the Heart of America. And a third example is Requiem for Detroit. But these films tend to have an elegiac quality, but they also expose the myth of class mobility in Detroit and cities across America. Other representations include the television series Low Winter Sun. It's a police drama set in Detroit, which created a narrative of gritty resilience in a dark and depressing environment. Fashion and advertising also present their own representations of urban decline in ways that try and make it look cool and transgressive. And then Chrysler produced television ads that tried to represent Detroit ruination as a prelude to revival. They made several ads that conflated Chrysler's recovery from their 2008 bankruptcy with the imagined future recovery of Detroit and used the Detroit rapper Eminem to create feel-good ads that immediately went viral. This fizzled out once the city headed for bankruptcy. But the ads were also rather deceptive in that they depended on the idea of a large, thriving working class that actually hardly exists anymore in Detroit. And they didn't deal with the fact that most parts and cars are in fact made in the non-unionized Sunbelt South. In fact, the city's decline is in large part due to the long history of corporate abandonment and the removal of manufacturing to white non-union areas. So Chrysler, Ford, and GM, they're still headquartered in Detroit, but their factories are elsewhere. But Chrysler banked on the fact that Detroit still stands for the auto industry, even though that industry has effectively abandoned Detroit. But back to your question, there are also sculptors, painters, and artists who've created large neighborhood projects about ruins and recovery in Detroit.
Is there something about this kind of ruination that people find pleasurable? I suppose is the question. I mean, is there a psychological element in the way artists depict what's happened to the city, apart from the horror of the kind of political and economic reality, which we'll get to? Are we all ruined pornographers in a way? Do we really think so?
Definitely. I think the pleasure of viewing scenes of ruin from a space of safety comes from the way it mitigates the anxiety of decline. We live in fearful times, made worse by the viral pandemic and natural disasters such as floods, tsunamis, tornadoes, hurricanes. But there are also man-made disasters such as warfare, nuclear meltdowns, climate change, deindustrialization and economic collapse. By picturing the beauty of decay or filming apocalyptic catastrophes, the terror these events produce are aestheticized and viewed at a safe remove that allows us to take pleasure in the experience. I call this the deindustrial sublime, which is, of course, in dialogue with the romantic sublime. The idea of philosophers such as Edmund Burke and Immanuel Kant was that the sublime depended upon mental distance in time and space for the enjoyment of a scene that would otherwise be too terrifying to endure. This led to a lot of ruin gazing, which became known as ruin lust by the end of the 18th century. At that point, the wealthy went so far as to build fake ruins known as follies. Probably the most famous of these was the rustic folly built at Versailles that allowed Marie Antoinette to play at being a shepherdess. Ruin gazing also produced the British Grand Tour, which included the Roman Empire, Greece, and the Middle East. The purpose of this was political because it allowed ruin gazers to confirm their own sense of superiority by gazing at the ruins of other civilizations. And Hitler's Third Reich, rather remarkably, tried to plan for their own future ruins. The architect, Albert Speer, conceived the idea of ruin value and used stone rather than concrete and steel so that Nazi monumental architecture would crumble in a picturesque way and produce future Aryan ruin gazers who would marvel at the spectacle of Nazi imperial power. But the notion of ruin value also suggests that the Nazis knew their power would come to an end because of their monstrous crimes. And so they wanted somehow to retain mastery over their own ruination. But they were foiled. Speer's Reich Chancellery, his most famous building, did not crumble picturesquely, but was bombed by Allied air raids and then razed by the Soviets. So the future realization of Aryan ruin gazing was defeated. I think it's also important to note that Kant distinguished between the sublime and the beautiful. Whereas the beautiful is found in nature and does not produce any tension in the viewer, the sublime, on the other hand, is not found in nature, but in the mind of the viewer, who overcomes and masters the terrifying. So the sublime is an aesthetic experience arrived at through contemplation, made possible by safety and distance. It tames the terrifying and makes it enjoyable. So I would say the anxiety of decline feeds the appetite for ruin imagery so that we can contain and control our anxiety through mental mastery and the pleasure that affords.
Is there a tension in this kind of representation between nature and industry or technology? You'll see vegetation growing around a column, that kind of thing, where there's some sense that the world is going back to nature and that may not be a wholly bad thing. Does that appear in the Detroit imagery that you look at? Sometimes it's used in Dutch art to mark the beginning of the new order, the Christian order, as opposed to the old Roman order. I mean, these ruins are often depicted as Roman ruins, of course, so that the old world is going, but nature is going to be a part of the new world. So do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, I think ruin photography and ruin imagery actually presents different perspectives. Uh-huh. And one is certainly the struggle between nature and culture. So Andrew Moore, for example, is known for this. And in his photographs, the struggle between nature and culture is won by nature. And nature represents a kind of renewal. So I think there are other images that don't have the kind of hopeful image of nature and renewal that Andrew Moore uses, mm-hmm. but instead they lament the decline of the city as a deindustrial wasteland with a kind of elegiac sorrow. And we can see this in the work of the French photographers, Marchand and Meffre. Or images may represent the ruins as sites of exotic discovery and transgressive pleasure, akin to exploring an imagined haunted house as a child. And we can see this in the work of urban explorers. Or they may represent ruins as places of danger and threat. We can see this in zombie and disaster films. Uh-huh. Or they might construct ruins as a backdrop to a resilient city making a comeback. We can see this in Chrysler ads. Or they can envision a future that regresses to an idealized pre-industrial past. So in other words, these images can be haunting, they can be mysterious, they can be seductive and beautiful. And in all these ways, domesticate our terror of decline. But I think ruin images also implicitly, whatever perspective they represent, they also represent a sense of a downward spiral, uh-huh. a halt in progress. So these different approaches imply different political and cultural perspectives, but all of them grapple with a kind of cultural pessimism and a loss of faith in progress. At the same time, they also challenge us to consider how our declining cities may be reclaimed and reimagined. Uh-huh. is part of an egalitarian society where cities meet the needs of their collective populations and help sustain the Earth's environment.
Really interesting. That's the heart of your book here, isn't it? That there may be something positive to come from all of this. It isn't just a matter of inuring ourselves to the inevitable decline that this imagery presents to us or reflects back to us about where we're headed. So do you have really negative reactions to some of the photography that you talk about here? You know, the really explicit sort of ruin porn that is obviously exploitive, that masquerades as a form of art, you know, oftentimes, that doesn't hook us up to any kind of possible positive outcome.
Well, I think ruin porn is a conflicted and problematic concept. On the one hand, there are those who revel in the beauty of ruins, who fetishize it, but care little about its causes or its effects on the surrounding population, and who are just out to commercialize it.
Yeah.
And a lot of ruined photography focuses only on the aesthetics of decay and architecture. And this has the effect of obscuring the ongoing crisis of poverty and unemployment. It reinforces the invisibility of the affected population, which tends to be poor and Black. And it obscures that to the corporations and the policymakers who are the agents of decline, the ones who help create the patterns of racialized poverty. But on the other hand, I think the phrase ruin porn may be used too dismissively. There are important political and psychological reasons that so many of us are drawn to the imagery of ruins. And I think it's more important to examine those reasons and to understand the work that these images do in containing and controlling our anxiety about decline than to simply dismiss ruin imagery as porn. And even if we accept the notion of porn as indicating a kind of pleasurable, emotional, or psychological arousal, then we need to understand why it has that effect and how it mitigates our fears. The term ruin porn originated with the Detroit photographer James Griffin because he resented the invasion of photographers from elsewhere who came and took pictures of the ruins and then left while he was living here with the ruins along with a lot of other people. So this articulated a felt divisions between insiders and outsiders, with insiders feeling a certain sense of ownership of the city and its ruins and resentment of the outsider incursions. But I would say that in terms of the imagery itself, it's pretty difficult to tell the difference between images taken by so-called insiders and those taken by outsiders.
Detroit photographer and a New York photographer, say.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And I would also say that Detroit's ruins don't just belong to Detroit. Because ruination is a national and a global problem that must be analyzed in terms of the failure of capitalism as an economic system to support its own populations. So it may be true that picturing the abject always carries a whiff of exploitation, but these images also serve as witnesses to history and picture scenes that otherwise might be lost or forgotten. I think photography is capable of producing powerful effects, and it's not anyone's job to dictate who can or cannot take pictures. While local artists might have more inside knowledge, those from elsewhere may offer fresh perspectives. But I think the larger fear of many Detroiters was that the proliferation of ruin imagery would bring about the alienation and the marginalization of Detroit from the nation as a whole. Detroit became the poster child of urban decline, and the state and corporations responsible for that decline preferred to blame the city, you know, the city itself for its problems. And this made the poor Black city of Detroit the place where everyone else could send their fears and nightmares.
Yeah. There's a racist element to that, isn't there? A big racist element. Even within the city, you know, with white flight people moving out to the suburbs. The interesting thing about your work is that you show the interconnectedness between art and wider cultural responses to anxiety. And it draws me to want to look at the art really carefully with a motive to try to understand how our social and economic problems might be addressed more intelligently, because it tells you about your own reaction to your own environment, in a sense, the art does. But on the other hand, you know, there is something that you feel is voyeuristic and objectifying and exploitive in some of this art. My story, I remember my grandfather, who actually worked all his life for Henry Ford in the Rouge plant, once offering a joking remark about a friend, a sort of Mr. Haney, that if he knew that the world were ending tomorrow, he'd be out selling tickets. And, you know, sometimes these photographers seem like that sort of Mr. Haney fellow, you know. But then I really understand you, that there's something about the nature of art that might offer solutions, and it's certainly worth thinking about these things and seeing these things represented.
Or they might at least ask questions. I mean, there are always those that are short-sighted and willing to exploit a situation. But I think it was really the corporate elite who sold out Detroit in order to make a bigger profit. Yeah. Jill Bennett talks about images as sensory emotional experiences and observes that aesthetic perception is conditioned by our everyday experiences with their pressures and anxieties. This means that how we make and interpret images is always transformed by our engagement with everyday life. It also means that images are interpreted and reinterpreted depending on the arenas in which they circulate over time. So it suggests that those meanings are always subject to change and are not inherent in the images themselves. And this is why what's most of interest to me is what symbolic work images do at a given historical moment and in a given cultural context.
Really interesting questions. Jill Bennett uses the term practical aesthetics here, doesn't she? Which makes me think of that whole American school of art history that comes out of John Dewey and pragmatism. That art has a function, in a sense. It isn't just to entertain.
Oh, absolutely.
So I really liked your big picture cultural thinking generally, and your analysis of science fiction narratives over the course of the 19th and 20th century, I really like, from Mary Shelley to Bram Stoker and modern zombie films. I teach an allegory seminar here at Vassar, and I'm very interested in science fiction because it's always perfect allegory, and it really does project the anxieties of the culture of its time, almost like nothing else. So the question is this part of the psychological and sociological response to identifying and managing our fears, that science fiction is, and is that why you wanted to write about it here? Because there do seem to be science fiction narratives about Detroit. I encountered one that you didn't mention. It was a video game that one of my freshman writing seminar students wanted to read as an allegory called Detroit Become Human. And it takes place in this kind of burned out landscape of the city. It's a first person shooter game, but it's also a hypertext game where you can choose where you want to be in the game at any given point, and generally where your allegiances are. So you can join the police that are fighting off a revolutionary group, or you can join the revolutionary group that's trying to make things better. And depending on where you are and what you do, the game changes. It's very interesting the way these games work, but I was struck that it was Detroit.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard of that. But we can definitely see science fiction films about fantasy disasters as a way of calming and soothing our cultural fears. I mean, it's true of Frankenstein and vampire films, which coincided with the rise of industrialization. And it's true of Cold War era sci-fi thrillers of killer monsters and mutants, robots, and aliens that coincided with the advent of the nuclear age and the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it's also true of contemporary films and television shows about zombie invasions and pandemic catastrophes, in which nuclear fear has never really gone away. But what unites sci-fi thrillers provoked by nuclear fear and recent zombie and disaster films is the collective imagination of apocalyptic threat and total social breakdown. They usually depict a small group of people who survive planetary catastrophe and start all over again. But there's also an important difference between the early sci-fi thrillers and more recent zombie films. In the 1950s and 60s, the heroes of sci-fi thrillers were scientists and the military, who usually collaborated to save the day. In today's zombie and disaster films, these forces are malevolent or incompetent or simply non-existent. In a half century, public confidence in the promise of science, technology, and global cooperation of the military and the state has drastically eroded. So we can say that anxiety about humanist progress, fear of national catastrophe, and urban ruination are the dark side of modernity. It burst into full flower in the US with Orson Welles' 1938 radio broadcast, War of the Worlds, about Martians landing. People thought it was real and it caused a nationwide panic. Then the government stoked fear of nuclear destruction following World War II by ramping up the security apparatus of the state and forcing school children to hunker down under their desks and even evacuating whole cities and encouraging families to build bomb shelters in air raid exercises. So the mentality of the security state has continued under every administration. And the massive scope of domestic surveillance was revealed by the whistleblower Edward Snowden, who just got Russian citizenship. We've also seen the proliferation of zombie and disaster films and books and television shows as industrialized cities have declined, and especially since the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in 2001. And this includes films like The Hunger Games, The Terminator series, The Matrix series, The Left Behind series, The Leftovers, and Under the Dome, which are all post-apocalyptic because of a viral pandemic or a nuclear disaster, or humans can no longer reproduce, or because the population has inexplicably disappeared. But zombie films are particularly fascinating, in part because the zombies have become more and more competent. The best known of these is the AMC television series, The Walking Dead, which began in 2010, based on Robert Kirkman's comic book series. So here, a man wakes up in a hospital to discover that an unexplained zombie apocalypse has occurred. He makes his way to Atlanta to contact the Centers for Disease Control, only to discover that the city has been abandoned and taken over by zombies. So much for science and government. But the protagonist, Rick Grimes, is told by a scientist who then commits suicide that everyone will turn into a zombie when they die, whether or not they are bitten, causing Grimes to declare, "We are the Walking Dead." And I think this really captures the flavor of cultural pessimism. Then the series focuses on strategies for survival by a small group of people. The Walking Dead, which ends this year after 12 years on television, became wildly popular and the most watched television program as recently as 2019, 2020. So the show relates to the key issues of our era: scarcity of resources, class, race, ethnic hatred, unemployment, dispossession, viruses, and direct environment. And if vampires arose with the advent of the Industrial Revolution to describe blood-sucking capitalists, then zombies have arrived with the globalization of capital and deindustrialization. So the vampire and the zombie embody the fears and anxieties produced by these economic and social transformations. The vampire was aristocratic, but the zombie represents the socially expendable, the migrant, the refugee, the asylum seeker, the impoverished, the unemployed. These are figures without autonomy who have been consigned to a biopolitical existence without rights. Zombies are an especially potent metaphor, I think, for non-standard laborers, the migrants who have lost control over their own labor power, who are rightless and stateless.
Yeah, a lot of people do identify with the zombies in these narratives. Very disturbing, though, even so. Didn't you mention in the book there was a group or an organization in Detroit who were allowing people to play in sort of group performances? There was someone who was exploiting this notion of zombies in the city, wasn't there?
There was someone who wanted to create a kind of zombie playground where
Zombie world, yeah.
they would take over several acres and buildings, and people would pay to be scared by zombies, basically. But the city ultimately quashed that proposal. It didn't happen.
The most fascinating and maybe frightening aspect of your book for me wasn't so much the exploitation of the city by elements of the art world, but your narrative of the way political and economic forces drove this decline, especially political forces, as government and the auto industry, underpinned by neoliberal disinvestment and racism, as well as old-fashioned capitalist greed, systematically sold the city down the river. I remember in the 50s and early 60s, a city where there seemed to be no line between the working class and the middle class, where money seemed to flow like water flows into the Detroit River to irrigate an entire community that was productive and had ample institutional support. At least it was seemed like that to me living in it, including the school systems, which were quite wonderful in those days. Even the auto company seemed civic-minded, or at least benign. I remember fondly visiting the Ford Rotunda every Christmas to see what seemed a whole universe of holiday automatons topped by a huge stairway that went up to where children could see Santa. And of course, there were a few new model Fords here and there. But maybe these things weren't as positive as I remember them. I mean, there were the seeds of this decline in the city at that time. I would have said, even as a child, that the problem is going to be the racial divide, that there's something wrong here, that racism was really eating away at the city, even when things look good to us white people living in the industrial suburbs.
Yes, you're right. The 1920s were a time of great wealth and growth for Detroit, with more than 500,000 people arriving in the city and skyscrapers rising downtown. It was also the era of factory growth, with Henry Ford's River Rouge plant, the largest factory in the world. But it was also an era of white rule and black oppression that was enforced by the Klan and other groups. So by the 1940s, thousands of Black workers came to work in the auto plants and joined the United Auto Workers Union. But newly built homes came with deed restrictions that prevented Black people from buying property. You had people like Father Charles Coughlin, a Roman Catholic priest who echoed Henry Ford's anti-Semitism and racist sentiments, and he became a very popular radio broadcaster. And there were also reactionary hate strikes in the auto plants, including a walkout by 25,000 white workers protesting the upgrade of three Black workers. This led to the dismissal of 30 white workers and the eruption of riots in 1943. Though a lot of people regard the 40s and 50s as a kind of golden age, but it was really a golden age for whites only. Historians tell a different story. Thomas Sugrue, in his seminal book, The Origins of the Urban Crisis, demonstrates that deindustrialization began immediately after World War II and that white rule and enforced segregation had devastating long-term effects on housing, jobs, and industry. UAW allowed the corporations to privilege white workers and segregate Black workers to the bottom of the workforce, doing the dirtiest, most menial work. And when automation came along, Black workers were the first to be fired. Meanwhile, factories were relocated to the suburbs and to small cities in rural areas, or to the Sun Belt South, and white workers were able to follow them while Black workers were shut out of suburban housing. So by 1960, the city was losing population and was already dominated by abandoned factory buildings, surrounded by blocks of boarded-up stores and restaurants. And this forced the remaining Black population to bear the brunt of deindustrialization.
So following through on this, what happened to those areas? I mean, you talk in the book about the city's bankruptcy filing specifically, and the dismantling of public institutions by monetary institutions through the courts. But I said it was sold down the river. It was really destroyed, wasn't it, over this period? It seems to have been. What was left of it?
Yeah, so the governor of Michigan appointed an emergency manager for the city of Detroit, effectively bypassing or usurping the elected city government. The emergency manager was in charge of all city resources and finances, and he took the city into bankruptcy. He then hired his own former law firm, Jones Day, which represented some of the very banks holding the city's debt. Jones Day wanted to cut city pensions, and Stephen Rhodes, a bankruptcy judge, ruled that the pension checks of retirees could be reduced, even though they were protected by the state constitution. So the lawyers from Jones Day made sure that the banks were paid off by forcing through cuts to the pensions of city workers, which averaged just $19,000 a year to begin with. Jones Day, by the way, is the same firm that was embedded in the Trump administration and helped pick the judges for the Supreme Court. And it wasn't just pension funds, which affected more than 32,000 city workers. They also slashed or eliminated medical benefits. So this was known as the grand bargain. Of course, it was only grand for the banks, who continued to make reckless investments, which led to the 2008 financial collapse because the banks knew they would be protected. The emergency manager could also privatize public resources as he saw fit, transferring wealth from public institutions to private corporate hands. And there were plans, for example, to privatize the Detroit water system. Those plans weren't carried out, but the emergency manager sent out crews to shut off the water to 3,000 homes every week. And this became a major crisis in the city. No such threats to cut off water were made to large corporations or institutions who were delinquent in their bills. And even running water in vacant and abandoned buildings were not shut off. But a massive demonstration in downtown Detroit was organized by National Nurses United. And even the United Nations stepped in, asserting that access to water was an international human right for all people without discrimination. So, under massive pressure, the emergency manager was forced to suspend water shutoffs and return that power to the city's mayor. After a few months, though, the mayor started cutoffs again, but on a smaller scale. So the courts, the banks, and the politicians collaborated to defend the banks and to try and privatize public resources.
So this resulted in an enormous movement of wealth from the many to the few here, what wealth there was, didn't it? And the way you describe it, it could be used as a model for other cities all over the nation, couldn't it? I mean, there's really something to stop and be horrified by here. You feel that the rule of law isn't working for the people here at all. And certainly the institutions like the banks and the political parties, frankly. I mean, this is the Republicans visiting a kind of holocaust on the city here, isn't it?
Absolutely. These austerity measures were, I believe, definitely foreshadowed the kind of austerity measures that the state wanted to implement in deindustrializing cities across the nation. And we all know that the income inequality gap has only widened in the last few decades and continues to grow wider. Since the 1970s, the modus operandi of neoliberalism has been to privatize government services, deregulate corporate industries, and cut social services and social spending. And because these measures do not benefit the vast majority of people, it has also meant massive assaults on privacy, democratic rights, and union busting. Neoliberal policies also compromise and degrade the environment, as exemplified by faulty safeguards on nuclear power plants, genetically modified organisms, pesticides, and water and soil pollution left behind when companies abandon factories. These are the consequences of corporate deregulation and so-called free market reforms. They lead to corporate enrichment while causing human, economic, and environmental disasters. Neoliberal globalization, we could say, is the embodiment of that old saying, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
Yeah, and the picture left behind is true dystopia, where nobody benefits. Even the wealthy, sooner or later, must realize that this will come to eat them alive as well. Maybe they don't, but it will. You mentioned that public collections of various kinds were affected by this move to bankrupt the city. Can you talk about the Detroit Institute of Arts and how it was endangered?
Yes, even the collection at the Detroit Institute of Arts was considered a city asset by the emergency manager, who thought that monetizing part of the collection was a reasonable move. The DIA is the fifth largest encyclopedic museum in the nation, with a yearly attendance of nearly 600,000 people, at least pre-pandemic. It has works by artists such as Jan van Eyck, Rembrandt, Degas, Cezanne, Van Gogh, Rothko, Warhol, and many others. So, museum directors around the nation saw selling off part of the collection as looting the museum, violating the public trust, and really spelling the end of Detroit as a cultural entity. The bond insurers argued that selling the art collection would help limit cuts to the pensions, which was a false equivalence. But the grand bargain sought to transfer the DIA to a charitable trust and raise money from private foundations and the state to be directed to the pension funds. The bond insurers, however, rejected even this deal, asserting that the proposal unfairly favored retirees over the banks, if you can believe that. The creditors didn't see the collection as a cultural resource, as a precious cultural resource, or a form of cultural capital, but as a non-essential city asset. But outrage was widespread, and protesters rallied and demonstrated in front of the museum. So, under pressure, Judge Rhodes denied the creditors the right to remove artworks from the walls of the DIA. Meanwhile, the people of Detroit and surrounding suburbs, in a rare show of unity, endorsed a tax initiative to fund the DIA, putting it on a secure financial footing for the first time in decades and providing free admission to residents of those counties. So, this is another example, I think, of naked greed and anti-intellectual bias by the corporate business elite and their political spokesman.
It is just horrifying. Talk about robbery. And then, of course, the recent history of education in Michigan generally should be a caution for anyone thinking along these neoliberal lines that the privatization of public education is a good thing, because it seems like a complete disaster to me, by all accounts. And I think most people that used to work in that segment of society, teachers in the public schools, would say the same thing.
Yeah, low-performing public schools in Detroit were privatized, with some run by a state-created authority and others by charter school operators or other private entities. When they were first taken over, students tested at mid-range for the state. Within a few years, student scores were the lowest in the nation, and they showed a greatly increased number of disciplinary incidents. Spending also went down while private school managers were enriched. In fact, public schools work well for most students. Problems arise when Republican governors, like former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, himself a former venture capitalist, slash hundreds of millions of dollars from public education to finance corporate tax cuts and then create inferior corporate-run private schools.
Part of the result is you get voters that can't pay attention to an election. If you don't educate people, you can't have a democracy.
Good point.
So, on the positive side here in your book, you do write about positive artistic responses to all this, like those of Sandra Osip and Scott Hocking, as well as other kinds of responses. So, can you talk about these? I mean, the artists that you've looked at for the book and the way those artists are responding positively and using art to try to find a path to a better Detroit.
Urban decline has inspired a variety of art projects in Detroit. Gregory Holm and Matthew Radun created Ice House Detroit, a project where they poured gallons and gallons of water over an abandoned house for several weeks during the winter, which gradually encased it in layers of ice. And this was meant as a critique of the housing foreclosure crisis, which hit Detroit particularly hard and created a haunting vision of a cold, foreclosed future. Another project was called Object Orange. Four anonymous graduates of the Cranbrook Academy of Art painted abandoned and structurally unsafe houses the Disney color Tiggerific orange to make them visible to commuters who were rushing home from the city to the northern white suburbs. And they only painted the side of the house facing the highway. Some of these houses that they painted were in fact demolished. Sandra Ossop, who you mentioned, was horrified by the destruction of neighborhoods, including the one she grew up in, and produced a 6-foot sculpture of abandoned and decaying houses jumbled together, which she called Beautiful Homes and Gardens. And Scott Hocking created sculptural interventions within the abandoned auto plants, producing mythic forms such as eggs and pyramids, using materials he found within the factories, which he saw as part of a cycle of creation and destruction. But probably the most well-known projects in Detroit are two neighborhood projects. One was developed by Mitch Cope and Gina Reichert, who imaginatively transformed a series of abandoned houses under the auspices of their nonprofit organization called Powerhouse Productions. And their goal was neighborhood stabilization through creative intervention. And they produced cleanup projects as well as artist residencies, including street artists who transformed abandoned homes into neighborhood cultural spaces. And then there is Tyree Guyton's Heidelberg Project, begun in 1986, the most internationally renowned art project, which draws tens of thousands of visitors from around the world. Guyton reclaimed abandoned homes along Heidelberg Street, where he grew up, and turned them into art projects using polka dots, stuffed animals, dolls, and thousands of other objects, creating sculptures and displays on the houses and surrounding areas. The project became a commentary on Detroit abandonment that drew international attention and appearances on shows like Oprah Winfrey and Good Morning America and the HBO documentary, Come On To Me, The Faces of Tyree Guyton. But the project also embarrassed and drew the wrath of Detroit's mayors, who twice sent in bulldozers to demolish parts of Guyton's work. More recently, arsonists have burned down at least 5 of the homes. Guyton has remained undaunted, however, and launched the Heidelberg Arts Leadership Academy in 2018. It's a free in-school or after-school arts education program for students in grades 4 through 12. And in this way, Guyton continues to help enrich overlooked Black communities in Detroit.
It's great. Art against fascism. It's wonderful. So, you know, of course, this isn't about just your backyard that you're writing about here in this book, but it's all of our backyards for those of us who live in urban centers and are seeing signs of what seems irreversible decline. So many of my discussions on this program, I found with scholars these days, seems to call up a sort of sense of hopelessness, whether we're talking about climate change, reactionary politics, ingrained racism, sexism, or globalization. But I find in your book that you present a role for art here that we haven't really yet imagined well in the past, maybe a more political role. Because it seems to me that art could play a redemptive role here if what we need is a revolutionary and even evolutionary change of consciousness that we don't seem to receive anymore from other sources, including religion, and not from the media generally. But your book does seem to have this about it. I mean, it's what makes it very positive and in some sense a sort of revolutionary document, I think.
Oh, I appreciate that. I think art always plays a political role and not necessarily even intentionally. I mean, this is the nature of practical aesthetics that we talked about, that it's not necessarily politically activist intentionally, but if it connects to our everyday life and to the anxieties and pressures of the historical moment, it produces an embodied response that affects our consciousness and connects us to other communities and subjectivities and collectivities in an empathic way. So, by affecting personal and cultural consciousness, art can help us better understand who we are, who we want to be, and what kind of society we want to live in.
This is to some extent what your book Calling Memory into Place was based on, also, wasn't it? The political role of art in memory and memorialization.
Yes, I guess we always write about the same subjects, how visual imagery can help create a better world.
So I'd like to thank you, Dora, for visiting with us again on the Library Cafe, this time to talk about your book, Beautiful Terrible Ruins, Detroit and the Anxiety of Decline, published in 2015 by Rutgers. Thanks very much for being on the show.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me, Tom.
Sure.